577, representing the appellant Largo Mitchell. Mr. Mitchell appeals the judgment of conviction entered against him on charges of robbery, conspiracy to commit robbery, burglary, conspiracy to commit burglary, and use of a stun gun in these two consolidated cases brought in the Boulder District Court. And Your Honors, even though we've briefed three issues in our opening brief, I want to focus this morning on the first and second issues. We'll rely on what's in the briefs as far as the issue of improper closing argument on the part of the prosecution. Getting to the first issue, the trial court's error in failing to include the elemental instruction on robbery, which defense counsel tendered, and instead giving the proposed instruction submitted by the prosecution. In preparing for argument today and in going over record and our briefs, it occurred to me last week that I probably made this issue more complicated than I needed to make it, and I want to try to simplify it today and get back on track. But basically, the issue that came up, and it's set out in the transcript of the instructions conference on December 14th. I think it starts at page 105 and goes to page 119. But the way the issue came up was the defense submitted proposed instructions that tracked the language of the charging document, the complaint and information, as far as identifying the two named victims in each of the two robberies. Prosecution submitted a different instruction that did not identify who the victims were. And in the exchange during the instructions conference, there was reference to the need to identify who the victims were. In my opening brief, I probably spent more time discussing that than needed to be discussed. But basically, the point I was trying to make in our brief was, and the people did identify this in their answer brief, we're not claiming that the court erred in failing to give a unanimity instruction specifically tailored to this case. That wasn't requested, and I think the people pointed that out in their answer brief. Our complaint is that the proposed defense, the defendant's proposed jury instructions would have solved the problem of identifying who the victims were without requiring an election by the prosecution and without a specific unanimity instruction. So in other words, the harm...
I'm really confused now.
Okay.
Unfortunately, because the proposed instruction identified both alleged victims as in the complaint for this two separate incidents. So you had instruction identifying two victims for each charge. So how does that solve the unanimity problem when you're claiming on appeal that they had to identify one victim?
Okay. Had the trial judge given the proposed instruction that the defense requested, Your Honor, basically they would have had to prove that they were both victims in each case. In other words, because it would have tracked the language of the charging document, which was in the conjunctive, not the disjunctive, they would have had to found that both Mr. Whalen and Ms. Wimmershoff were the victims in the first robbery, and Ms. Cross and Mr. Schlickmeyer, I believe it is, in the second.
But the statute doesn't require that there be two victims for this crime, just one.
That's correct, had it been pleaded that way, but it wasn't. The way it was pleaded was that it was pleaded in the conjunctive. And our point is that the prosecution should have been held to what they charged.
So I'm like Judge Jones, very confused about where your argument is on appeal. Are you asserting a unanimity problem, or are you asserting some sort of constructive amendment issue? What are you saying now is your position?
We're saying that what should have been done was the proposed instruction that was submitted by trial counsel, which would have been that both victims in each of the robberies were the victims in the conjunctive.
And the failure to do that caused what problem? A constructive amendment, a unanimity problem,
That's where we get to. We don't know who the victim was based on the way the jury instruction went in, or the victims.
But if they had been pled in the conjunctive, both were victims, could they also have charged two crimes per incident?
They could have, I think, theoretically, Your Honor.
And why did your client want to be charged with two crimes for each?
He didn't. Okay. He didn't. But this is just the way they charged the case, and our position is they should be held to the way they pleaded it.
And the result being a lack of unanimity on which person was the victim of each robbery?
That's correct, because the way the instruction was, I think it referred to person or the presence of a person in the singular. If I can just check the instruction that was actually given. The instruction that was actually given was from the person singular, or the presence of another. And our position is it should have tracked the language of the charging document.
So on appeal, despite your opening brief, you're not saying that the jury should have been instructed to pick, to unanimously agree on which victim was the, which person was the victim of each robbery?
I would concede that that was not requested by trial counsel. And I don't know if it's realistic for us at this point to have expected the trial judge, to sua sponte, take that action.
But isn't that what your argument was in your opening brief?
That's part of the opening brief, but we're sticking to, I want to focus on what was preserved in the record rather than what might have been.
So you're abandoning any argument of that they should have got the modified unanimity instruction talked about in Thomas and Astorga, et cetera?
That's correct. And I want to stick to the failure to give the instruction that we requested, which would have addressed this problem.
Okay.
If there are no other questions on that, the only other point I wanted to make about the failure to give the proposed instruction was the prosecution took the position that it wasn't necessary to identify the victims, and they relied during the instructions conference on three cases, Palmer, Lewis and Linares Guzman. And it's our position that those cases are distinguishable because they involve burglaries. And I think trial counsel pointed out that we were not making the request that the victims in the burglary charges be identified, just the robbery.
Let me ask you this, counsel. It's well settled among our case law, among other appellate courts, that we're not going to consider new arguments raised for the first time at oral argument.
Okay.
So why should we consider your new change of heart as to what you really wanted to argue?
I think it's included in our opening brief, Your Honor. I think it's on page 11 and page 12 of our opening brief. All right. Bottom of page 11, district court erred in refusing to give the defense proposed jury instructions and overruling the defense objection to the proposed instructions submitted by the prosecution, which omitted the identity of the alleged victim in each robbery.
Well, that's a heading.
That's a heading.
But the argument seems to be specifically that the court was required to identify a single victim for each charge. That's the argument in the brief, but that's not your argument today. It doesn't seem. I mean, is it? Am I misunderstanding something?
I mean, you seem to concede at the outset that that was not your argument in your opening brief. That's why you tried to clarify it.
Yeah. My problem, Your Honor, is that based on, the record is not ideal as far as how I would like to have seen it made. And I've got to try to work with what's in there. And what's in there in rereading this, the only thing that trial counsel brought up was the failure to give the instruction as requested. So I'm trying to focus on that.
I agree that would be a good approach to begin with when you're writing the opening brief. I'm not sure that you can change horses in midstream at this point.
Well, and I think it's mentioned in here in a few other places besides the caption, okay? First paragraph on page 12 during the instructions conference, defense counsel raised the issue that the prosecution's proposed instruction on robbery did not identify the specified or specific alleged victims. I think going on to page 14, last paragraph, neither the jury instructions nor the verdict forms identified a particular victim in each robbery by name, although defense counsel objected to the lack of any such identification. All right. Then I went off on the failure to submit interrogatories or unanimity instruction. If you go to page 16, page 17, deals with the failure to use the instruction. So it is in there. Unfortunately, by going off onto the other stuff about the unanimity instruction, I got sidetracked.
Okay, thank you.
I have about 5 minutes left, so I want to quickly talk about the other issue, which is the admitting the evidence that the co-defendant in the severed case, after he was arrested, ingested a small baggie of meth while he was in police custody. And I think it's clear this has no relevance to my client's case. All right. My client wasn't charged in a drug possession case. At trial.
But he was charged with stealing drugs.
He was charged with stealing drugs. Well, he was charged with stealing. Okay.
And some of the items that he was alleged to have stolen were drugs.
However, this was never shown to be the drugs that were stolen. Okay. And in reviewing the material, Your Honor, in this case, it came out very clearly at trial. Prosecution brought in items that were recovered, which they then tied in to items that were, they identified as items that were taken from Mr. Smalley's apartment. I believe there was electronic equipment, there was a sword, there was a safe, and these were items that were identified as having come from the victim's apartment. There was nothing showing that the meth that was in the baggie was somehow chemically similar to any meth missing from the apartment. In fact, I think one of the witnesses testified there were no drugs missing after the first robbery, and they couldn't say whether there were drugs missing from the second. So I think that there's a missing nexus there.
Counsel, even if we agree with your argument that, you know, this information had no relevance and the trial court never should have allowed it to come in, on this record, what assurance do we have that this evidence in particular influenced the verdict or impaired the fairness of the trial? There was plenty of other fairly damaging testimony that, you know, probably overshadowed information about the co-defendant having meth.
Well, Your Honor, and I think this came up at one of the pretrial proceedings. It was either the motion to consolidate or the motion to join. And I believe that the judge that ruled on that kept the brothers' cases separate, and for some reason another trial counsel had them joined, or had the two cases for my client joined together. But the judge made the observation that she wasn't going to sever because of this issue. She said, while this evidence is inadmissible as to Largo Mitchell, a jury could properly be instructed to disregard it. But it's our position that if she felt that it was inadmissible as to my client, it was inadmissible. Now, getting back to your original question about how does this harm him, this was a piling on of bad character evidence, Your Honor. And we can't say that this wasn't what broke the camel's back as far as depicting my client as a bad person who would engage in this kind of behavior.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions, I have about a minute and 40 seconds, which I'd like to reserve for rebuttal.
You may.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Brock Swanson, attorney registration number 39116, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this matter. It was our position in the answer brief that the defendant had not re-raised this issue that he had raised in the trial court on page 29, that he had abandoned it. And I think that reading the opening brief, that it is not fairly comprised within the issues raised there, the idea that the jury should have been instructed on that it had to prove both victims were victims of the robbery in order to find him guilty of those counts. But I think it also fails, that argument also fails on its merits, because it is essentially an amendment claim. And under our notice pleading standards, the defendant is on notice that he is subject to liability on any of the alternatives that are alleged within a complaint. And there's a statute on that issue is section 16.5.2023, and that is cited in the brief. which specifically says that pleading in either the conjunctive or the disjunctive shall place the defendant on notice that the prosecution may rely on any or all of the alternatives alleged. So that the prosecution was not required to prove both of the victims just because they used the word and in the complaint when listing the victims for those charges. I'd also like to just indicate that I don't think that there is any potential prejudice here regarding unanimity under the facts of this case. Even if the jury had been given a unanimity instruction or required, let me say this, I guess just not necessarily arguing about a unanimity instruction anymore, I guess. For each of these robberies, there were two alleged victims, and while the jury could have disagreed potentially about whether both of them were robbed, I don't believe under the facts of this case it could have reasonably disagreed about which victim was robbed. Therefore, we can be reasonably certain that the jury unanimously agreed on the same victim for each robbery conviction. So in the first robbery, there were two alleged victims, KW and JW. And the testimony regarding that robbery by a co-conspirator, Ms. Neeson, was that KW started yelling when the brothers began taking things, and they eventually used a stun gun to subdue her, and she had injuries that were consistent with being tased. On the other hand, the testimony regarding JW was less strong, that he had stood by the door talking with the defendant and said this didn't have anything to do with them. So I don't think there's any reasonable possibility on this evidence that the jury would have found him guilty and not all have agreed that at least KW was a victim.
Mr. Swanson?
They wouldn't have been able to disagree about which one.
It seems like, if I understand your argument today and in your briefs, you're suggesting that the evidence and the arguments were heavily weighted towards showing the female victims were robbed in each robbery?
So that's correct.
And if that's the case, I'm wondering why didn't the prosecution just name the female victims or agree to in the elemental instructions? Because that seems to be the theory of the prosecution.
You know, I can't answer necessarily what was going on in their minds. It's possible that they were not certain about what evidence was going to be able to be produced at trial.
This was after trial, right, in the jury instruction conference, when the question became whether to name any particular victim in the elemental instruction?
The prosecution just submitted the most current model jury instruction and the instruction that tracks the statute, which it says another person. And the defendant didn't request that, and I just don't think that issue came up or crossed their minds at that point. They had charged both victims. There was evidence that both of the victims in each count had been robbed, and so I don't think it necessarily occurred to them that they should limit that at this point.
Thank you.
Answer your question. I don't know necessarily what was going through their minds. So
thank you.
At that point, no. I guess if the defendant is abandoning his unanimity and election claims, I won't go through my arguments addressing those unless you're interested in hearing that.
Well, just humor me. Assume for the moment that we endeavor to resolve the claims raised in the opening brief. Mm-hmm. What is your response to some of those claims?
Sure. As I talked about with the prejudice, I don't think there's any prejudice here because there's not the potential that the jury disagreed on which victims. Going beyond that, I think there's also this was tried and prosecuted under a single transaction theory by the prosecution. And thus, under Molina, the defendant was not entitled to election or a unanimity instruction. The considerations that appeared to be relevant to the court in Molina were the charging decision and the theory of the case, and both of those the prosecution proceeded on one count. There were never any argument that we have here two complete crimes and you can choose either one of them. The prosecution just proceeded on the concept that there had been one robbery that took place and that these were both victims of it, and that they had both been victimized during this single robbery. And Another consideration was whether the evidence was interrelated. This isn't two robberies that occurred at different times with different victims in different ways. This is all one single discrete incident that occurred. And then whether double jeopardy would bar a subsequent prosecution. And I think here, given the complaint and the verdicts, that it would bar prosecution as to both of those victims in this case. So I think under Molina, it was tried and prosecuted and as a single transaction, and thus a unanimity instruction or a election would not have been required, even if they had been requested. And then finally, I made this waiver argument. This is essentially the argument made by Justice Coates in his concurring opinion in Molina. And I don't believe anything in the majority opinion forecloses the concurring opinion. And I think the concurring opinion correctly analyzes the relevant Supreme Court case law. There's a significant strategic benefit in cases like this to not challenging a duplicitous charge. If it had been timely objected to, it would have permitted the prosecution to amend the charges and charge each one individually.
Mr. Swanson, can I ask you about that?
Yes, absolutely.
Under your view of, well, Justice Coates' dissent, as well as some of the cases he talks about, Astorga and Thomas, by what time must the defendant request the election or the instruction? Or put another way, when is it too late for the defendant to make this request?
I think that it depends on the nature of the defect. I think in this case, the defendant was on notice as soon as it was filed that there were two victims named, and there's case law saying that there can be separate charges brought for each victim. And so at that point, he knew as soon as it was filed that these could be brought as two separate charges. And then he had, under Rule 12, he had, I believe it's 21 days after arraignment in order to bring that up. And then after that point, I would submit that it would be untimely in this case.
So, for example, and the reason why I ask is, in Astorga, the defendant did not make this request for an election until the close of the people's evidence, which obviously Astorga found to be a timely request. And so how is this case, and you seem to be suggesting in this case that would have been too late if the defendant waited until then to make that request.
Right. I think it can depend on, and I'm not recalling exactly the facts in that case, but it can depend on the nature of the issue. There may be a case where it does not become apparent until the evidence is developed at trial or when the prosecution presents its theory that there is a duplicity issue or a multiplicity issue or another different kind of issue with the information. And so I think then it would become at that point. The defendant would have cause to bring it up at that point if it hadn't been apparent earlier that there was this issue existed. Does that answer your question there? No. So
yes,
I think it depends on the facts.
The strategic value to the defendant, in your view, would be to avoid having the prosecution amend the charges to perhaps add additional charges.
Correct.
The prosecution wouldn't be able to do that after a trial has begun, barring some unusual circumstances. So, and that after trial has begun, the strategic value to the defendant in failing to object seems to go away. There's no risk at that point to objecting. So why should we assume it's strategic at that point to fail to require an election by the prosecution?
Let me see if I'm understanding this correctly. So if the strategic benefit in failing to object after, as soon as the issue arises, I guess it would be that the prosecution already knows how they're going to be the evidence and that how they're going to be prosecuting the case. So if they have not sufficiently informed the defendant of that until it becomes apparent at trial, then the strategic benefit has come there, but they've also sort of brought the loss on themselves of not being able now to amend it by not presenting that to the defendant so that he was in a position where he needed to bring this up earlier. Does that answer? I guess.
I think so. I think you're saying, if I understand, that in order to attribute any strategic decision making, we have to first figure out when the defendant was required to request the election. Because if it was not until after trial began, then there'd be no strategic value, and so this whole theory of strategy seems to go away.
And maybe I'm Again, it's a little too complicated. I mean, Rule 12 says 21 days after arraignment, and then after that point, it's untimely. So I think it's untimely at that point. You just may have cause based on subsequent developments to bring it up later. Cause such as it's not, it's become subsequently has developed into something where now you think you have a claim that you didn't, weren't aware that you had before.
Mr. Swanson, just to follow up briefly on this, is it your position then that the issue is waived? You've used the word waived or forfeited. The distinction being, if it's waived, can't be raised on appeal at all. If it's merely forfeited, it can be asserted under plain error.
It's our position that it is waived. That it cannot be presented under plain error. And I'm sure you're referring to the Zadra opinion here. And the people would respectfully disagree with Zadra's conclusion that CRIMP 12b creates only a forfeiture, not a waiver, for several reasons. And the first is that I think that result is inconsistent with Cropper and Hinojez Mendoza. In those cases, the Colorado Supreme Court held that counsel is expected and indeed conclusively presumed to know the applicable rules of procedure, even when faced with an assertion of actual ignorance. And two, that counsel may validly waive, not merely forfeit, the defendant's rights, even their constitutional rights, by failing to comply with those rules. So here, counsel failed to comply with a procedural rule requiring his duplicity claim to be timely raised. Therefore, it would be our position that he waived the defendant's right to election and with it any right to unanimity instruction. The second is this, that it seems inconsistent with the language of the rule itself. It says waive, and we generally give the words their plain meaning. And further, the rule contains an express standard for addressing untimely claims, which is this cause standard. And I think Zadra reads out that requirement. Indeed, the primary case relied on by Zadra, which is this United States v. Johnson Seventh Circuit case, actually concludes that the defendant is required to show both plain error and good cause. And the people would agree with that standard, that once a defendant shows good cause, then the issue is no longer waived under the plain language of the rule. It's only unpreserved, and then plain error should apply to it. But here, the defendant has not even alleged any cause for failing to raise his claim in the trial court. I think most of the cases cited as supporting plain error review in Zadra simply did not even address or mention Rule 12. The result in Zadra, applying plain error without any showing of good cause, despite an assertion that the claim is ruled under Rule 12, does not appear to be directly addressed and supported by any of the cases cited. So it would be our position that that it is waived and not merely forfeited.
Just make sure I understand the lie of the land here. Zadra, in your view, goes against your position. You don't have any case from Colorado in favor of your position. You rely on this minority opinion in Molina. Is that basically the sum total of the
that's
of
the
your support?
Directly addressing it. There are two other cases that I cited in my brief that found duplicity issues to be waived. They're Colorado Supreme Court cases under that rule. Now, obviously, that was before the waived forfeiture had been well developed, but they found them waived and therefore not a problem.
I think I know which cases you're talking about. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. I see I'm out of time, so I'll. We respectfully ask that you affirm the judgment of conviction.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Mr. Borges, you have a little over a minute. Go ahead.
Unless the panel has any questions for me, we would just rest on what's in the brief and the opening argument I made and ask that the judgment of conviction be set aside and remanded for a new trial.
All right, thank you. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.